This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. You probably know our guest, Ethan Hawke, from some of his more than 80 film roles. The young prep school student in Dead Poets Society, the young rock musician in Reality Bites, the rookie cop in Training Day, the divorced father in Boyhood, the romantic lead in Before Sunrise, Before Sunset, and Before Midnight, and more recently as the troubled priest in First Reformed. He's also directed films, written screenplays, novels, and a children's book, acted in award-winning theater roles, and more. Hawke has been nominated for 4 Academy Awards, 2 for acting, and 2 for script adaptation. He's now starring in the 7-part Showtime series The Good Lord Bird, which he co-produced and co-created. The first episode aired Sunday night. It's based on the novel The Good Lord Bird by James McBride, and it tells the story of abolitionist John Brown through the eyes of a 14-year-old slave who's freed by Brown and joins his band of anti-slavery soldiers. Ethan Hawke plays John Brown, the fanatical opponent of slavery who was hanged in 1859 after seizing an armory in Harper's Ferry, Virginia, hoping to spark a slave rebellion. When the series opens, Brown and his sons and followers are riding through Kansas in the 1850s, seeking to liberate slaves and battling with pro-slavery militias. In this scene from the first episode, it's nighttime, and Brown and his sons have burst into the cabin of a farmer who's allied with the pro-slavery paramilitary group known as the Red Shirts. While the terrified farmer's family looks on, a menacing John Brown, played by Ethan Hawke, addresses the man.
I have come to deliver his holy redeemer's justice, free his people, and exact his revenge for the murder, rape, and kidnapping of the Negro by slavers, those like yourself. All those involved! There are no exceptions!
I'm just a farmer trying to make a dollar, change pockets. Hey, I know you.
I'm talking now. I will ask you for a final time. Are you for or against slavery?
Yeah, I'll say anything you want to hear.
Make up your mind.
Yeah, I can't think straight with that big sticker on my chin.
And that is our guest, Ethan Hawke. A very imposing Ethan Hawke in the Showtime series, The Good Lord Bird. Welcome back to Fresh Air, Ethan Hawke. Before we talk about the project and the role, I want to talk about some of the history here. Explain what happens to this farmer after he has this encounter with John Brown in his cabin.
Well, this is early in the novel. McBride addresses the Jim Doyle murder, which John Brown is, you know, kind of legend has it he chopped Jim Doyle's head off. And that's largely responsible for why a lot of people say he's insane. Whether or not he actually did that or not is not clear. We just say he did in the show because a lot of people think he did. John Brown was a nonviolent abolitionist until his early 50s, and his sons moved to Kansas to stake a claim so that they could vote against slavery because Kansas Territory was about to become a state, and people thought that if that state turned and became another pro-slaver state in the Union, that it would be really bad for the abolitionist movement. So the abolitionists were trying to settle down there. Well, the cotton barons had the same idea, and they would pay people from Missouri and Alabama, et cetera, to move there and vote for slavery. Meanwhile, there were also anybody who was a pro-slaver. You know, they didn't just hate black people. They hated anybody who was friends with a black person. So the boys, the brown boys, got their crops burnt, and they would be getting a lot of gunfights, etc. John Brown gave up his nonviolent ways. This coincided with the passing of the Dred Scott Act, and he went down there. He was very angry, and he picked up, you know, became a gunfighter for the gospel. And he basically decided that if he just started killing some of these settlers, that maybe they wouldn't send any more settlers. Now, our story, and that's kind of a basis of the factual historical point of view. McBride's telling the story from the point of view of Onion, this kid, Henry Shackelford, who John Brown thinks he's freed, but the kid thinks he's kidnapped, and he takes him along for this murder. Now, obviously, John Brown doesn't think it's a murder. He thinks he's on a holy mission, and he's going to provoke a war. And he finds out when he gets there that this guy is actually just a farmer who doesn't even own any slaves. But he's so full of the righteousness of Abraham that he decides he's going to go through with the murder anyway.
Right. It's really an intense moment. And, you know, this is a moment when the nation was divided by slavery, but it was nowhere more intense than in Kansas, because the issue was these expansion territories, would they be slave states or free states? So it was really a very raw point. A lot of violence. John Brown was said to have actually, I believe, hacked to death five settlers in a set of incidents. It was said that some of his sons were really traumatized by this, even those who took part. It's really tough stuff, no, for sure. You know, and I got to say, I mean, looking at the first episode, I just had this feeling that there was something about it that feels like the United States in 2020. I mean, the crazed partisanship and violence, the feeling that there are issues of enormous, you know, political weight and moral import, and it's there's something that's really a little crazed about the way people are looking at each other.
Well, that's the hope of when you make art, right, is that you can make meaningful, substantive conversation about what people want to be talking about. And, you know, I've heard all summer throughout this pandemic, we've all heard the word systemic racism. You know, I've heard it more in the last 6 months than I heard it my whole life. And to really understand that expression, one has to look at slavery. And there's really no better place to put your microscope than John Brown, because he puts his, you know, he started the Civil War. The Harper's Ferry, to my mind and a lot of people's mind, is the first battle of the Civil War. And it's a moment in history that brings up a lot of conversations. First off, why we're not taught about John Brown in school. And it's a really good question. When I was doing this movie, The Magnificent Seven, I think it's 2014, and I have to do a scene that day with Denzel Washington. And in the scene, I have to, you know, yell at Denzel, you know, because my character was a Confederate soldier, and he was really burdened with the memory, you know, his PTSD, with the memories of all the violence, and he doesn't want to fight anymore, and Denzel's trying to talk me into fighting, and I can't face the war, and Denzel says the war is over, and my character has to shout, the war is not over, it's never go over, it goes on and on. Strangely, I'm on set that day, and the cinematographer says to me, you know, you should play John Brown. I'm like, why? What makes you say that? He said, well, I'm reading this book called The Good Lord Byrd, and it really just, it stuck in my head, and I had to read it, and then I started reading it, and I just started laughing my ass off. And see, I do think the show really does speak to today's moment. And the magic trick that McBride does by telling the story through Onion's point of view is he lets you laugh about it. He lets a humanness into it as opposed to kind of a political angle. It's not self-serious, and yet it's full of tremendous heart. So it lets you look at this word systemic racism that's so hard to look at. Because to look at it, you have to look deep into the ugliest part of America, the foundation of America, this thing that nobody really wants to think about, and all they're talking about the Constitution, you know, that three-fifths of a human being. It's really ugly and terrible, and the more you study it, the more terrible you feel it is. So most of us don't decide it's too terrible, I can't look at it, I don't want to see that. But McBride finds a way to make it a kind of just a healing experience to look at it. The wit of his writing is so compelling. And so when I finished it, I just felt hell-bent on a mission that getting this story into our culture so that it's easier to talk about some of these things.
He's always quoting scripture, barking scripture a lot of the time. And he's also really funny. Was it hard to integrate the humor with this kind of this fanatical commitment to this cause?
This is where I had to just trust James McBride and try to preserve what I love. The genius that he gets at is making you laugh at subject matters you're not allowed to laugh at. And so this thing needed to be just incorrigible. And there is something deeply hypocritical about John Brown. His religion is such a big part of his life. His faith and his dedication to Jesus Christ of Nazareth is complete and educated. And he loads his pistols. You know, he's got five pistols on him. And so there's a little hypocrisy right in that. It's like, well, did you read the Sermon on the Mount? But in that hypocrisy, or, you know, quote unquote hypocrisy, is you find the man. Both are true. You know, we live in this country right now, everybody's into dualistic thinking. It's either this or it's either that. Nobody wants any kind of nuance, or you're either on this team or you're on that team. You can't actually have a discussion about ideas. It's just this polarization one way or the other. And the truth always is more complicated than any kind of dualistic way of looking at things.
Did you improvise much on the set?
You know, much to every director that's ever worked with me's frustration, it's very difficult to shut me up. I loved this character. I read his letters. I was constantly hunting for that little detail. You know, the detail that he had a pet squirrel for 17 years. I was like, this guy had a pet squirrel for 17 years? And he cried when it died. I mean, and they, you know, somebody once in one of his letters was asking him about, you know, losing his wife and these children, wasn't it hard? And he goes, well, you know, I'd already lost Jesus. So, I mean, he took the death of Jesus like a death of a friend. And so I was, when I would find out these little, their little windows into the man, you know, these eccentricities. And so I always try to keep a collection of my character's inner life and let it spill out whenever anybody takes too long of a pause.
You got into acting at a very young age and were in a movie at age 14 with River Phoenix, right? And then were in Dead Poets Society with Robin Williams at age 18. And I think you were only 24 or so when you did Reality Bites, the movie with Winona Ryder, which kind of made you an iconic figure of Generation X, or at least that's the way it's remembered. You had a lot of success early. You know, we talked to a lot of actors, and it can take a long time before you have an impact. And I'm wondering, that kind of success, was celebrity a good thing for you?
You know, I can't imagine that it's actually a good thing for anybody, particularly a young person. I think that it can bring a lot of gifts, celebrity, you know, the power to do what you want to do and open doors. But if you're too young, you don't really know how to use it in a way that is beneficial to yourself and others. And so it can be really confusing. You know, and a lot of young people struggle with, oh, not thinking they're good enough, not thinking they're smart enough. And if you throw oil onto that fire, which is by telling a young kid that, oh, you're amazing, you're great, and inside your own chest, you don't believe it, you start drifting off because it balloons the feeling of being a fraud. If you know you haven't earned your place at the table. And I think for me, you know, I always like the way that athletes think, you know, that you have to play as you practice, and the more you practice, the better you get. And if you just kind of put your nose to the grindstone and keep practicing, things will get better. But if you kind of worship all the false gods, you'll end up setting yourself on fire.
A lot of people remember you in the film Before Sunrise. That's the film where you convince Julie Delpy to get off the train and wander around Vienna with you. Your first film with Richard Linklater, who you had a long collaboration with. I'm wondering what you saw in him or learned from him in that first film, or what clicked that kept this collaboration going?
It was pretty thrilling to meet another young person that had given themselves permission not to imitate the generation before them, you know, and was setting about to define who he wanted to be, and was really looking at the context of the time period we were living in. And that was, it might not sound important, but everybody I met, we were all like, oh, I want to be like X, and I want to be like Y, or I want to be like Jack Nicholson, or I want to be like August Wilson, or I want to be like, you know, whoever it is. And this was a young person who was saying, no, what are we going to be? I don't want to be like anybody. I want to speak to this moment the way that our heroes spoke to their moments. And it was kind of revelatory to give yourself permission to not imitate. And he challenged me, and we became friends. And I, you know, he was a constant resource on the Good Lord Bird.
I guess in the late 90s, there was a point, I was surprised to read this, where roles weren't coming your way, and you kind of had to go to Hollywood to do auditions. What did that feel like?
I don't know. You know, whenever you act like you're too good or deserve better, you know, you're pretty much announcing yourself as an idiot. The life of an actor is constantly up and down. I mean, that's one thing. People have this notion that, you know, you cross some threshold and you've made it or something. You know, no sooner do people write nice things about you than it becomes unfashionable to write nice things about you, and they have to come up with a negative angle about you, and they're probably both true. I don't know. To be frank, I enjoyed it. I hated how easy success came to me. You know, I was embarrassed by it. And I know too many artists that work too hard, too many musicians and people who are brilliant who can't, you know, sell a record, or painters who can't get anything. But I'm just, you know, the world, the commercial art world is an extremely unreliable critic. You know, mediocrity is celebrated constantly, right? Through the history of mankind, not just in our culture, but, you know, so I tried to not take any of the ups too seriously or any of the downs too seriously, and try to orient myself more on like what my goals were rather than whether my goals were succeeding.
Well, you ended up getting the role in Training Day with Denzel Washington, which was a huge hit. How'd you get that role?
Well, I was lucky. I mean, that was coming out of like what I like to call the second time I was washed. There's been like three times I felt washed up in my life. You know, and by times, I mean year spans. And I had, you know, Reality Bites had opened and I was supposed to be this Gen X, you know, the poster boy for Gen X. But then all of a sudden that became unfashionable. And so you couldn't get, you know, I was only 29, 30 years old and people thought I already had, you know, oh, I know him and I don't like him kind of thing. And so you have to, I went out and auditioned, but largely I was really lucky. Antoine Fuqua, the director of Training Day, really believed in me. And Denzel really believed in me. And they, you know, I had to come in and screen test and everything, but I knew that they were angling for me to get that part. And they were my advocates. And, you know, the studio, you know, everybody wants to work with Denzel, right? So, I mean, you can imagine everybody wanted that part. And I was fortunate that they saw something in me. And it turned into a really unbelievable experience in my life.
You kept going back to theater at times, right? And I'm wondering why, what drives you back to theater? What's important, compelling about theater that's different from film?
Well, my joke about the theater, you know, you can, you know, sit down and skim through all the channels on TV. You very rarely see somebody just acting terrible. But if you go to your local theater or Broadway or the West End or anything, invariably you see one person or three people in any given production that are terrible. It's because it's much harder. It's just so much harder. And when you're on stage, it's your time as an actor. There isn't a cinematographer to help you. There isn't an editor to help you. Nobody's like turning up the music or the so that they can't hear that weird squeak in your voice. They're not cutting around your trembling hand. You know, it's a place, it's a fire where you can really build yourself, walking in front of 1,000 of your brothers and sisters and learning how to be relaxed is a spiritual exercise.
And it's energizing to do that every night and succeed?
It's energizing because you actually have contact with your art. You know, the problem with a movie, like one of the things that's so exciting for me about even doing this interview with you, I love to hear like when you talk about the movie, what it made you think. And I don't have interaction with the audience like you do on stage. You know, I did this play Hurley Burley and with Bobby Cannavale, and Wally Shawn, and Josh Hamilton, Parker Posey. We is a great group of people. And some nights we had pure magic on stage, but you knew some nights we lost them. Too long of a pause at the end of act one, too indulgent in the drinking scene. You know, it's like it's a razor's edge between what is electric and what is mildly interesting, you know? And it's a question of energy, and learning how to carve that energy on stage lets me know how to do it on camera when I don't have an audience there.
You were afflicted by stage fright at some point, right?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, I don't know how you could spend your life doing this and not. Well, some people don't, but I definitely did. I was an extremely confident young man. And then sometime my late 30s and 40s, right when you're supposed to like be a grown-up, when you have to stop being promising and start delivering, I started getting incredibly nervous and had a genuine war with anxiety.
Would you freeze, not remember your lines?
That's not real. I'm not saying that didn't happen, but that's not the way it manifests with me. The way it manifests with me is that I think I'm going to die. Literally die. Like, I think I'm going to die when I go on stage. Like, die. Like, be executed. And that's much more scary than your lines. The lines I had, lines are really just preparation. It becomes, I guess it has to do with self-esteem, and my only source of self-esteem through much of my life has been through what I do. And if I didn't succeed at that, then I had no self-esteem, which means I hated myself, which means I may as well not be alive. And so I think in some way, that's the circle of negative thinking that can get you going. And so it's not like people who don't act think it's about learning your lines. It's like, I could care less. I mean, you know me enough on this phone call or this interview that if I don't think of the lines, I'll make them up. I'll tell you a funny story. Sir Tom Stoppard once came up to me after a run of a show, and I said, how did it go? And he said, the show owes a great debt to your energy, your passion, your heart, your enthusiasm. If you could say one line as scripted, my cup would overfloweth.
Wow. Well, you know, when you said that it made you feel like you literally were going to die, I mean, I would think that would be horribly distracting. And did it show in your performances?
You know, mysteriously, it helped. I mean, you know, it's harnessing. I had an incredible drive to excel at my chosen field. And as I got more educated about what excelling means, it became more difficult to get to the level that I wanted to be at. But that anxiety kept me up all night working, you know, and that helped me be better. The trick is to figure how to make a friend of your fear and to realize that this fear is helping you rehearse longer, work longer about movement, work longer on voice, work deeper into your inner life. You know, like every little, the difference between good and great is like this fraction that is everything.
Well, Ethan Hawke, congratulations on the series, and thanks so much for speaking with us.
My pleasure.
Ethan Hawke stars as the abolitionist leader John Brown in the Showtime series The Good Lord Bird, based on a James McBride novel. It airs Sunday nights at 9. The 40-year-old Virgin won a directing award at this year's Sundance Film Festival for first-time filmmaker Radha Blank, who also wrote and starred in the movie. The story, which began as a web series, was inspired by Blank's own experience as a playwright and rapper in Harlem. Lena Waithe was one of the producers. It's now showing in some theaters and streaming on Netflix. Our critic Justin Chang has this review.
While the American film industry still has a long way to go in nurturing movies made by women and people of color, the Sundance Film Festival has long provided an important platform for marginalized voices. This is the festival that recently introduced us to pictures like The Farewell from Lulu Wang and Clemency from Chinonye Achukwu. 8 years ago, Ava DuVernay premiered her film Middle of Nowhere at Sundance and became the first black woman in the festival's history to win Best Director for an American drama. This year, Radha Blank became the second black woman to earn that prize for her first feature, The 40-Year-Old Virgin. It was a worthy winner, not just because it's a terrific movie, but also because it's specifically about the challenges of making meaningful, personal art from an underrepresented perspective. Blank's artistry has many facets. She has a sharp ear for comic dialogue and an exquisite eye, having shot this movie on gorgeous black and white 35mm film. She also gives a very fine performance as a fictionalized version of herself, also named Radha Blank, a struggling artist from Harlem who was hailed years earlier as a promising playwright. Now just a few months shy of her 40th birthday, she has little to show for that promise, besides a play that she's been working on for ages. She pays the bills by teaching drama at a local high school and spends a lot of time commiserating with her talent agent and longtime buddy, Archie, played by Korean-American actor Peter Kim in a sly riff on the gay best friend trope. Archie urges Radha to seize any and every opportunity, even if it may require some compromise. At a party one night, he steers her toward Jay Whitman, a powerful theater producer played with delicious smarminess by Tony Award winner Reed Birney. Whitman has read Rada's play, and he has some feedback on the story, which follows a black couple in a fast gentrifying Harlem.
That's it?
No. It's about gentrification. And how this young couple struggles to you didn't like it.
The idea is powerful.
But?
It rang a little inauthentic.
Okay. Well, thank you for that note. I appreciate it.
There's something there.
Okay.
I just wish you hadn't shied away from darkness. I mean, if you're going to call it Harlem Ave, you got to give me Harlem Ave.
I should write in a teen mother shooting up in an alley.
No. No, you're missing my point. Okay. I'm talking about gentrification.
Mm.
A black Harlem shifting under a white hipster land grab.
Mm.
But your play never goes there. I ask myself, did a black person really write this? No, look. Sweetheart.
Yes.
There's definitely a voice under all those words.
All those words.
But the writing needs work. The good news is, I still need a writer for my Harriet Tubman musical.
After some tussling, Whitman does eventually agree to produce Rada's play. But he demands numerous changes, including the introduction of a white co-lead, in order to show the face of gentrification itself, and of course, draw a larger audience. Blank clearly delights in skewering the tone-deaf condescension of white men who fancy themselves cultural gatekeepers. But one of the reasons the 40-year-old version is so disarming is that Blank saves the toughest criticism for herself. She lets us see her character grapple with deep insecurities about her talent, her calling, and her future, sometimes with tears, but more often with a well-timed, self-deprecating jab. At one point, Rada decides to abandon theater and reinvent herself as a rapper, seizing upon a long-ago passion that she hopes will tie her more closely to a strong community of black artists. And so begins a wide-ranging tour of New York's hip-hop scene, from a boxing ring in the Bronx, where female rappers go ferociously head-to-head, to a Brooklyn club, where Rada does some recordings with a gruff but sensitive DJ, played by Oswin Benjamin. Rada's talent in this arena is more than apparent, even if her nerves sometimes get the better of her, like when she freezes on stage in front of an audience that includes several of her high school students. If you cringe for Rada in that moment, as I did, consider it proof of how deeply Blank has secured your emotional investment in her journey. That's no small feat, considering all the crowd-pleasing underdog drama cliches the story could have stumbled into, but somehow avoids. A more obvious telling of this story might have ended with Rada discovering her true calling as a rapper, or figuring out how to put on a successful version of her play that stays true to her creative vision. But Blank seems less interested in clear resolutions than in examining how these two distinct worlds, theater and hip-hop, have shaped her complex identity as an artist. She doesn't feel entirely at home in either space, and yet her work, at its best, becomes a bold synthesis of both. As fast and funny as much of it is, the 40-year-old version also has a rich vein of melancholy. There's an elegiac quality to the black and white images, which might bring to mind vintage New York pictures like Manhattan, Shadows, and She's Gotta Have It, Spike Lee's equally auspicious 1986 debut. As it happens, She's Gotta Have It recently spawned a TV series for which Blank wrote a few episodes. But it would be a mistake to squeeze her into any kind of mold based on her influences. Rada Blank already has a voice that is gloriously her own, whichever version of it we hear next.
Justin Chang is the film critic for the LA Times. He reviewed the 40-year-old version. Our guest today is Lenny Kravitz. He's written a new memoir about his early life and coming of age musically with the release of his first album, Let Love Rule, in 1989. It launched his career and made him a rock and roll star. Since then, he's sold over 40 million albums and won 4 Grammys in a row for Best Male Rock Vocal Performance. He spoke last week with Fresh Air producer Sam Brigger.
In his memoir, Lenny Kravitz talks about growing up in New York as the child of an interracial couple and his loving relationship with his mom, actress Roxy Roker, who's best known for playing Helen Willis on The Jeffersons. But his relationship with his dad, Cy Kravitz, a TV news producer, was much more difficult. The memoir is also about living in L.A. as a teen and struggling to find his musical voice while getting kicked out of his home by his dad and having to sleep in a car. When Kravitz met actress Lisa Bonet, he said he found his musical voice and wrote the songs that would make up the album Let Love Rule. They married and had a child, actress Zoe Kravitz. Let Love Rule is also the name of his memoir. I spoke with Lenny Kravitz from his home in the Bahamas. Let's start with the title track from the album, Let Love Rule. Love. That's Let Love Rule by Lenny Kravitz. Let Love Rule is also the name of his new memoir. Lenny Kravitz, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Well, your book starts out with your parents, so let's talk about them a little bit. Your mom, Roxy Roker, was a black woman with Bohemian heritage on her dad's side, and she was an actress. She was the first person in her family to go to college. She went to Howard. And at the time she met your dad, she was working as an actress, but she also had a day job at NBC as an executive secretary. And that's where she met your dad because he was a news producer for NBC. His name is Cy Kravitz, and he was a white Jewish man. And this was in the mid-60s when they became a couple. Did they face a lot of prejudice as an interracial couple?
They did. You know, I heard stories about people spitting at them in the street. You know, them not being able to go to certain places. My father once took my mother somewhere and they had to get a hotel. And the person at the desk said, no prostitutes allowed. And, you know, even her parents were fine with it after a conversation with my father. His parents, unfortunately, at the time that they got together, couldn't really accept that. First of all, she wasn't Jewish, and on top of it, she was black. And, you know, that was an issue for them. They hadn't gotten to that place yet.
And it took you, right? Like, because they didn't go to the wedding, but you sort of brought peace back to the relationship, right?
Yes. After my mother had me, I think they showed up the next day. They were very curious. They knew that their son had had a son, and they wanted to meet this grandchild. And they came to the hospital, and they met my mother. And very quickly, they bonded. His parents saw the character of my mother and fell in love with her. And that was it.
So, you know, your parents were young, and they were working a lot, and for childcare, you'd spend weekdays at your maternal grandparents in Brooklyn. So you grew up shuttling between your parents, who had a small apartment on the Upper East Side, and then the home of your maternal grandparents, who lived in Brooklyn and Bedford-Stuyvesant, these two very different neighborhoods. And you say that you see yourself as having these very different sides to yourself. In the book you write, I'm deeply two-sided, black and white, Jewish and Christian, Manhattanite and Brooklynite. My young life was all about opposites and extremes. As a kid, you take everything in stride. So I accepted my Gemini soul. I owned it. In fact, I adored it. Can you talk a little bit more about that? Like, it also seems like that at times that it was confusing. Like when you went to PS6, your first day, you were walking in with your parents and a kid pops up and yells, your mother's black and your daddy's white. And this sounds like this was upsetting and maybe also the first time you were confronted with these ideas of race. Is that true?
Yeah, because I never thought about it. I knew that my mother's skin tone was what it was, and I knew that my father's skin tone was what it was, and both sides of the family. And on top of that, my parents being artists in New York City, you know, they had friends from, you know, virtually every background and religion. I thought nothing of it. People look different. People are different. People have different customs and traditions, and that's life. And so then I go to school, you know, first grade, so I'm six now, and my parents walk me to school, and I suppose my parents were the only ones that didn't match. And this kid jumped out and pointed his finger and said that, you know, your father's white and your mother's black. And it was more shocking because he jumped out and pointed his finger and he was kind of loud, you know? So it was like, what is this statement and this action?
Yeah, it sounds jarring.
Yeah, and that's when the conversations really began with my mother about race and, you know, perception of things.
Yeah, that night, I think, or later that day, your mom could see that you were upset, and she talked to you about, like, you know, a way to think about your identity. And I think she explained it very, really well. What did she say to you?
For that time, it was a really good explanation. And at my age, you know, she wanted me to understand that there were two sides to me. And she didn't want me to feel like I had to pick one or one was better than the other. She said, your father, you know, is a Russian Jew. This is his background. And I want you to be proud of that. And I want you to know about it and understand it. You know, we are of African descent, you know, by way of the Bahamas. And that is your culture. And that is beautiful as well. And I want you to accept that. She said, but society is only going to see you as black. They're not going to see the other side.
Well, let's talk about how music influenced you as a young kid. It, you know, it sounds like you had this innate ability to remember tunes and melodies would stick in your head, and music was always around you. But when you heard the Jackson 5, that changed you. You thought of yourself as the sixth Jackson brother, right?
Like, oh, yeah. I used to write in my notebook, Lenny Jackson. You know, I had this fantasy that I was the long-lost brother, and they were going to find me, and then I was going to join the group.
Would you be lead singer, or what would your role be?
Oh, no, I'd have been—no, nobody could outdo Mike.
Yeah.
Not possible. That's one in a universe. I mean, his genius was incredible. And so I identified with him, the music, the appearance, the whole expression.
You know, early on, it sounds like you were intrigued by the combination of like the music and the visual style of your early idols. Like you were both studious of how rock stars made their music, but also how they created their look. Is that right?
Well, yeah, they were like superheroes. They didn't look like people on the street.
That's right.
You know, they wore clothes that you didn't see folks wearing. I mean, I did see a bit of that around my mother and her friends because they had a really great sense of fashion, and you know, this is the late 60s in New York City, so they're wearing really, you know, cool clothing. But yeah, I was aware of that, you know, that there was a sound and there was a visual presentation, and that they went together. They amplified each other.
You wrote your first song around that time called I Love You Baby. Do you remember it, enough of it to sing or give us some of the lyrics?
Other lyrics, that was it, man.
Oh, that was it.
I Love You Baby, over and over and over and over again. That was the only, it was, there was one line. And somehow I guess I knew you had to have I Love You and you had to have Baby, for sure. Actually, no, there was another line. It was, I love you, baby. I love you, baby. I love you more and more each day. That was it. So that was the extent of my first song at like, you know, 6 or 7 years old.
So, Lenny, a big turning point in your life was when your mom got the part of Helen Willis on a new TV show called The Jeffersons. And she was going to play half of the first interracial couple on primetime TV. So that was a big deal. It also meant having to move across the country to L.A. So I just wondering, did she have any reservations about like leaving her New York theater scene or even working on a sitcom at that point?
I don't think so. She was on Broadway at the time in a play called The River Niger, put on by the Negro Ensemble Company. And Norman Lear came to that play, saw her, met her, thought that she'd be perfect for the role of Helen Willis on his new sitcom, The Jeffersons, which was a spinoff from All in the Family. And, you know, he had her come out to L.A. I think she was quite happy to do so. And then she got the part. And I was told that we would have to go to Los Angeles. She had friends who said, you know, don't go to L.A. and sell out, you know, TV. You know, you're a theater actress. But, you know, my mother was a grown woman, you know, and had worked hard. And this was an opportunity to break into television, to make more money, to support the family. I mean, along with my father, who was working. And she went for it. And Los Angeles became my next education and my next location where I learned things that I never would have learned in New York City.
Yeah, well, one of the things is that your mom convinced you to join the California Boys Choir, which is a pretty rigorous choir, and you would, you know, have concerts in large halls and Hollywood Bowl and appear in operas. And it sounds like you really enjoyed it. Yeah, you liked the music. You met some good friends. And you say you learned a lot about vocal techniques that have served you well in your career. Can you talk about what you learned then that you still use now? Because you're doing different kind of singing, for sure.
Of course. Not only that. I mean, first of all, the discipline. Now, of course, I had discipline in my life, but this now was musical discipline. And you know, they pushed us. This was serious. The California Boys Choir, you know, we had to learn to sing in, you know, 15 different languages. You know, we didn't learn the languages, obviously, but we learned how to pronounce everything perfectly with proper accents, you know, from Latin to German. I mean, everything. And, you know, we learned how to sight read and, you know, vocal training and how to support the voice and staging, stage presentation, you know, because we were also doing operas. It was a very solid foundation and an experience that gave me this education that I base everything that I do on.
You became a teenager and you went to high school at Beverly Hills High, probably the most famous high school in the country. And this is the 80s. You're really into the 80s new wave scene. You're inspired by Prince and David Bowie. And you kind of do that new romantic look that was popular at the time, like you're wearing ruffled shirts and there's some androgyny to your clothing. And you're smoking pot like all the time. You're sneaking out at night. You're creeping into your parents' bedroom, stealing your mother's cars, rolling your car down the hill until you can start it. And then
I'd have to steal the car keys, which was
in their room, right?
That was about a 30-minute operation, you must understand, because, you know, I had to open the door to their bedroom and not have them hear the click. I then had to get on my hands and knees and crawl to this closet that was very close to my parents' bed. I'm talking about like it was probably, you know, 3 feet from their bed. And I had to, you know, reach my hand in there in the pitch black. And there was all kinds of things on these shelves. And find the keys, get the keys in my hand, you know, get back on my hands and knees, close the door, crawl back out of the room. I mean, that was a 30-minute thing. I dreaded that.
You never woke them up?
Not once. They never had an idea that I was stealing their car. I had no license. You know,
you were 14, right? Weren't you?
Yeah, 14 and 15. Yeah.
And
I'm driving
then
this car
dancing all
at night,
right?
In LA, you know, in the middle of the night, going to clubs, going to the Odyssey, you know, and then I would have to get the, you know, 5 in the morning, I'd make sure I was back. And we lived on a hill up in Baldwin Hills, so I had to go very fast with the car, turn it off as we were approaching our driveway, coast into the driveway, make a turn into the carport while the car was off. You know, the power steering would shut off. I mean, it was a whole thing. But I was dedicated because that's where I was having my adventures at night, going out and hanging out in these clubs and hanging out with all of these, you know, people of the night, you know?
Did you ever tell your parents you did that?
Later, as an adult, yes. I was like, come on, you didn't know? Come on, I was stealing your car every night. What's wrong with you? My mother, God bless her, I mean, she, you know, she was very pure. And I mean, she didn't, you know, she didn't know I was smoking weed until I was, you know, making my second album. So I hid all that stuff really well.
Well, Lenny Kravitz, thanks so much for coming on Fresh Air today.
It's been a pleasure.
Lenny Kravitz speaking with Fresh Air producer Sam Brigger. Kravitz's new memoir is called Let Love Rule.